Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane. Last night in his State of the Union address, President Obama said, quote, "The shadow of crisis has passed, and that it's now time to boost the economic prospects of the middle class." Response from congressional Republicans has not been enthusiastic. Joining me to talk about the president's address and how, if at all, it may shape priorities on Capitol Hill, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, David Winston of the Winston Group and an advisor to Republicans, and Carol Lee, the White House correspondent of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome. Nice to have you all here.
Good to be here.
1-800-433-8850, as always, is our phone number, drshow@wamu.org. There's Twitter, Facebook, all sorts of ways to communicate with us. And I want to ask each of you, briefly, give me a takeaway, something that you learned, something that you noticed last night that you thought was significant. David Winston, why don't you start?
Well, I think in looking at it, it was two speeches. There was the sort of first 50 minutes, which was very partisan, very much focused on what he wasn't going to do in terms of vetoes, focused on basically his agenda after having suffered a huge loss in this election. It's almost like the election didn't happen. And I think that's probably where he's going. The second part of the speech was, now can we all get along and sort of work together, which sort of had some moments of optimism. Unfortunately, I think he's going to be like the former. And I'm going to tell you, those proposals are basically dead on arrival. I mean, he knows that. And he just lost an election to go back to the basic same proposals that he had had prior to the election. I'm not sure that the White House understands what just occurred.
Carol Lee.
I think my biggest takeaway was that his main concern seems to be that his legacy is going to be overseeing a recovery that left the middle class behind. And when he declared that the crisis was over, he essentially said that every aspect of the economy except for the middle class and lower class Americans has fared well, and that is something that he sees as what should be his focus in the last 2 years in office, and also something that he really wants to try to net some sort of gain on before leaving office in 2017.
EJ.
This is good news, people. And I thought that line was very revealing. Because
Which was an ad lib. It wasn't an ad lib.
Exactly. And it came after a passage in which he said that, everyone said my policies were misguided, too ambitious, would crush jobs or explode deficits. And then he was saying, but wait a minute, it all worked. And I think that was a predicate for the rest of the speech, where he was saying, look, my adversaries out there said all my policies were bad, and so we are in a situation of conflict. They're going to start by repealing Obamacare and passing something on the XL pipeline. I'm at least going to put my agenda out here. And I think it reflects in part a different reading of the election. As David said, the Republicans' view is clearly that they won the election, they won all these Senate seats, they control the Senate. The Democratic view is this was one of the lowest turnouts since 1942. Our people are asleep. We need to give leadership and say what we stand for. And that's what he did in the first part of that speech.
David said that there were two speeches. In some ways, part of what Obama was saying was there were two elections to remember.
Correct.
Yeah, we lost in 2014. But as he said in another ad lib, I won in 2012, and so you got to pay attention to both elections, Carol, right?
Yeah, that's right. It reminded me of this moment when the president first took office and he had his first meeting with congressional leaders, and he said privately they were challenging him on what he wanted to do, and he said, I won. And there is a sense that he feels that even now. And part of his argument is going to be that not only did people criticize his policies before that he says worked, but because of that and that they did work, he feels that he has some credibility on where to take the economy next.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And David, there's a kind of irony here because, as EJ says, good economic news. I mean, that is hard to deny, although there's still stagnant wages for a lot of workers. President's public opinion ratings on the eve of the speech, way up. ABC Washington Post poll up to 50%, the highest in a long time. 41% confidence in the economy, up from 27%. But the irony is that at the moment when the economy is looking good news, people, his polls are up, he faced a Congress that was tilted against him in far more decisively than in the past. 300 Republicans sitting in that audience.
No, and again, this is the largest House Republican majority since the 1920s, right? And so, I mean, it wasn't like there was a small gain. I mean, this has been a huge gain. And you look at the state legislatures across the country as well. But let me go back to one point that EJ was making and Carol were making. When the president addressed the Republicans and said he won, what he was basically saying, this is the direction I want to go and I just won. What Republicans are saying, we just won. Let's sit down. And this is divided government. How do we make it work? And the president basically went back on stage and he said in his speech, I won the last two presidential elections. And so he wasn't moving an inch in terms of willing to sit down and negotiate things. This was going to be about his agenda. And I think part of what this election was about is what should that agenda be? And that's where the fight is.
I think it's about negotiating style, if I could.
Yeah.
Early on in his administration, there seemed to be a negotiating style that said, look, I'll give you guys the asking price right from the start. Now let's go from there. And I think the president learned something in 6 years. That didn't work for him. And when you've got your opposition out there saying, we want to repeal the core of your agenda, not only Obamacare, but also the Wall Street reform piece by piece, there's no point in your going out there and saying, well, I'll meet you halfway. I think the decision is clearly, I'm going to start with what I want. And by the way, a bunch of these ideas are quite popular. How are you going to oppose sick leave? How are you going to oppose the community
college? But let me ask you this. Do you think it was an opening bid in a negotiation? Or was it a platform for 2016?
Both. Absolutely. It's clearly he is looking at his legacy, not only how people will look at his presidency, but does he influence the debate that came after, as Ronald Reagan did, who, by the way, lost the 1986 election and was not asked to stop being conservative when he lost the Senate in that election. And it's he is thinking very much about that long-term argument.
Carol, let me ask you about some of the specifics, because, were spending programs, in a sense, but he was talking about using the tax code, which is often a Republican idea. He wasn't talking about a new government agency to oversee new child care credits or a credit for two-earner families. What was the strategy behind his tax proposals, you think?
Well, it was a multifold. The Republicans and the White House have wanted to do business or corporate tax reform. There's much more overlap, and that's further along. But the Republican argument has been, well, we need to do both and also do individual. And the White House has kind of resisted that. And so what the president did over the weekend was put out a marker. And it's exactly like EJ said. They've changed their debating style and negotiating style in the sense that they used to go in at the middle, and now they try to go in all the way as far to the left, if you will, that they can to try to give negotiations broad running room, and so he doesn't have to perhaps concede as much. But another piece of what he was trying to do with that proposal is really lay out his wish list. I mean, this is an ideal world, what he would want to do. Thirdly is the politics. I mean, it's clearly a political jab. He's been having this debate about raising taxes on the wealthy for years, and it's never worked. It's not something Republicans have gone for, and they're not likely to go for it now. But what he's doing is forcing the Republicans to come up with their own ideas and answer the questions about why they would oppose these things. And secondly, he's inserting himself in a debate and trying to maintain his relevance at a time when a lot of presidents would fade off the stage or at least be in their final act.
David, now a lot of Republicans are very negative, and yet as it's been mentioned, a number of these proposals have had Republican authors or Republican endorsement in the past. The fees on banks, for instance, Dave Camp, the former Republican chairman of Ways and Means, was in favor of it. Some of the ideas about better supporting two-earner families, as Republicans have endorsed. And the language the president used over and over again was almost identical to the words the Republicans used: hardworking, opportunity, growth. So why was the Republican reaction so negative?
Well, first off, it's the meaning behind the words. What was he actually saying versus what Republicans are saying? And I would argue that those are dramatically different things. And I also think that, again, think of this. If George Bush, after the 2006 election, had come back in his State of the Union 2007 and had argued for what we really need now is a lot more tax cuts, I mean, it's not recognizing the reality of the election that just occurred. I would suggest that Bill Clinton understood how to manage it, and in fact did manage it to, and I worked for Newt at the time, did manage to turn things around and work cooperatively with a Republican Congress, and we ended up with a terrific economy benefiting everybody. This president is doing the exact opposite. Rather than trying to figure out a way to make it work, what he did is, I just lost a huge election. I'm going to lay down a marker that I know is dead on arrival, because I want to create a political fight at a scale that is larger than when we went into this election.
But George Bush, let me just don't you also think that there's a kind of a personal animus here? I mean, the Republicans never, even though they try to impeach him, never quite hated Bill Clinton the way they hate and distrust Barack Obama.
Now, again, this goes back to the way he is, and I would suggest this attitude isn't just Republican members of Congress, it's the way he's treated Congress and dealt with Congress. He has done a remarkably poor job of interacting with Congress to try to move things forward. And it's been a structural problem in terms of his administration and the way he's handled policy.
That's David Winston, Republican advisor, strategist. Also with me, E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at Brookings Institution, and Carol Lee, White House correspondent of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and we'll be back with your calls and your questions, so stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. And from Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international correspondents, who take great risks to keep listeners informed.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane, and today we're talking about the president's State of the Union address last night, the beginning of his final 2 years in office. E.J. Dionne, who writes a column for The Washington Post, senior fellow at Brookings, is with me. Also David Winston of the Winston Group, an advisor to House Republicans for many years, and Carol Lee, who covers the White House for The Wall Street Journal. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. E.J., you wanted to take issue with something that David said.
Yes. David said after the 06 elections, Bush was somehow conciliatory. After an election that was decided, I think most pollsters agree, by voters who were sick of the Iraq war, instead of backing away from the war, Bush doubled down and did the surge. And a lot of Republicans at the time said, and in some ways it's quite true, that Bush was very courageous. In the face of this election, he put in the surge. Similarly with Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, Clinton and Gingrich didn't come to terms until Bill Clinton stood up to the Republicans in the shutdown on that famous list of Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment. So, again, I want to go back to the idea that Obama can't be asked to concede his philosophical position when Republican presidents have never been asked to do that.
But Bill Clinton also stood up to the base of his own party on issues like trade and welfare. And I want to ask Carol, one of the issues that emerged last night that the president talked a lot about is trade, a very critical issue that you've written a lot about in the Wall Street Journal. And here's an issue, perhaps number one, where there is at least a potential for bipartisan cooperation, because a lot of Republicans and a lot of business interests supporting the Republican Party very much in favor of giving the president what's called fast-track authority, which is to negotiate a trade deal and submit it for an up or down vote in the Congress. That authority has lapsed years ago. The president said last night he wanted it back. What are the prospects on that issue, and including the willingness of the president to stand up to the left of his party, particularly the labor unions, who are very much against this?
That's one of the big questions, because if you looked at the speech last night, it was when the president mentioned trade and said he called on both parties to pass fast track, that the Republicans stood up and applauded, and the Democrats sat on their hands. So that kind of demonstrates the work he has ahead of him.
And virtually the only issue on which that was true.
Yes, exactly. And this White House has never, as we've already discussed, been very good at the congressional relations piece of it. This president has not stood up to the party, if you'll remember his own party. If you remember last year during the election, he took trade off the table and under pressure from Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi.
Harry Reid said he wouldn't bring it up in the, wouldn't bring it up in the Senate.
That's right. And he also didn't want him running around talking about it during an election year because it put all these Democrats on the spot. Now the White House has a decision to make, and whether the question is whether or not they can build a coalition with the Republicans and peel off some of the Democrats. And the view is that it's possible, but it's going to take a lot of work.
What's your view?
I think that it's doable, but it'll take a lot of work. And I've yet to see this White House really engage in congressional relations in that way and really work individual senators or lawmakers to try to get something that it wants, particularly when you're trying to get Democrats to do something that they don't want to do.
What do you see, David, on the issue of trade? Do you think this is an area where there's a possibility of cooperation? And will the Republican business community, which is very much in favor of trade deals, be an important factor here?
If there's one area where I think progress will clearly occur, I think trade is certainly it. In terms of the critical element in terms of getting something to his desk is likely to be is something put together that can get through a filibuster in the Senate. Now, again, oddly, roles are reversed here in terms of Reid now being in the minority, but still having more than 40 votes. And so the question is, and this is the challenge to the president in terms of his own party, can he do enough things in terms of those trade agreements to at least get six Democratic senators to be willing to support him?
Now, yes, quickly.
Can I just say that one of the problems for both of them on this is that Americans don't really care about trade. The Wall Street Journal and NBC had a poll this week that showed it ranked last, lower than closing Guantanamo Bay in terms of what people's priorities were.
That's partly because the selling job has been so poor. Right. People don't understand how many jobs are related to trade, how many folks can buy cheaper goods that are imported. They don't understand the economics.
Because we haven't even gotten to the debate. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say there's mistrust of free trade on the left and the right. I think first of all, let's acknowledge right up front that, to use a Harry Potter reference, trade is the Lord Voldemort of the Democratic Party. They would really rather not mention it at all because this really splits Democrats. And the president knows that. And what was striking is the arguments he made for a treaty. He put it all in pro-worker terms. Let's us write the rules. He was clearly talking to Democrats. The danger, I think there's a good chance it passes, but the danger is an alliance between pro-labor Democrats and some of the Tea Party Republicans who worry about issues like national sovereignty. And so I think this is going to be a very peculiar set of alliances on both sides.
Let me bring up another issue that Joni Ernst, the freshman Republican from Iowa who gave the response, Carol, highlighted, and that's the Keystone Pipeline. This is the president has issued a series of veto threats, including one on Keystone. This seems to be the one that could be most troublesome for him because the Republicans, as Joni Ernst did last night, cast it very much as a job creation bill, right? And there are a lot of unions who look at these construction jobs and who see the value of it from their own personal interest. Give us a rundown on Keystone and where that stands.
Well, the White House has done everything it could do for years now to not make a decision on this. So what it's to understand their thinking on this. Basically, they're fighting this on process. So that Congress is saying we're going to pass this bill and authorizing the pipeline, and the White House is saying, well, that's not the way the process is supposed to run. It's a process that goes through the State Department. There was a court decision in Nebraska. They were hoping that that would go in a direction that would alleviate the president from having to make a decision. That didn't happen. So he's going to have to make a decision. And in the meantime, he's saying to Congress, this is not the way to make a decision about this. It's not something that should be done legislatively. And I'll make a decision. And so that's why I'm going to veto this. At the same time, he's really started to show his hand on where he's leaning on this. And he's gone back and forth depending on where the politics of it have been at different times
over
the last couple years.
One of the few issues that he or veto might be in question, whether it really he really could sustain it, right?
Well, I think if you look at where the votes are, it's not clear that he would have that they have 67 to override a veto, if that's what you mean.
And they appear in the House to have to be able to sustain a veto. I mean, I think one of the interesting dynamics in the next 2 years is that a group that has been accustomed to being powerless since 2010, the House Democrats, have a lot more power in a curious way because Obama's
when it's really a veto issue, he's
going to need House Democrats to sustain his veto.
David, I want to ask you a little bit about Joni Ernst. It was interesting that she was chosen, freshman Republican, only a few weeks in office, but emblematic of an important change in Washington that happened this month. 13 new Republican senators, many of them quite young. She's 44. Some of them, like Tom Cotton of Arkansas, in their 30s. Only one new Democratic senator, 13 Republicans. Also, if you look in the state houses, Republicans have a much deeper bench of younger rising stars. Talk about the larger political implications of picking Joni Ernst.
Well, again, going to your point, the election here wasn't just simply the House getting the most members they had since the 20s. This is the largest amount of state legislatures we've ever had. There are 23 states where the process is completely controlled by Republicans, legislature and governor. There are 27 states where it's Republican legislature. I think Joni Ernst represented to some degree that sort of that new kind of Republican, winning in a very difficult state, a state that is central in terms of 2016, someone who took on a sitting Democrat House member who was considered at the beginning strong, although later on maybe he didn't prove that as well as he would have liked. But also, I got put in a very difficult situation. Look, doing a response after the President of the United States has that sort of grand stage to be able to sort of and stand up as a freshman member and deliver the performance she did, I thought was really quite remarkable. It was a well-put-together speech, well-crafted to say Republicans have a different view, very nicely done. We've seen other speeches where Republicans didn't actually carry that well. So I thought her first step out into the national stage was quite a strong performance.
EJ, doesn't this have to worry Democrats when they look at the fact that the Republicans have so many fresh faces in the Senate and state houses where the Democrats say, well, we've got Hillary Clinton and then who's next on that list?
It absolutely has to worry Democrats that when you look at the pattern of the last four elections, Democrats sort of like to say, and it's true, that there is this big midterm drop-off, that we dominate the electorate when it's a big turnout, and the Republicans dominate the electorate when it's a small turnout. So in the long run, Democrats say they're in good shape. That's broadly true. The problem is that if you keep losing midterm elections, what you do is you wipe out your bench, because these losses going all the way down to the state legislative level are very serious. And there is you have Democrats coming up. It's interesting that probably if Hillary Clinton didn't run, the two leading contenders would probably be women, Amy Klobuchar and Kirsten Gillibrand, I think. But you don't have a deep bench. So Democrats have to solve this midterm turnout problem.
And let me ask Carol, I want to turn to briefly to a couple of foreign policy issues as well, because it's a cliche that has historically been true. I covered the White House under Ronald Reagan's last 2 years, and his signal achievement of his last 2 years was going to Moscow and his rapprochement with Gorbachev. And often, second-term presidents, particularly in the final quarter, as the president likes to say, of his last 2 years, do turn to foreign policy, because there tends to be a bit more national unity on that, gets away from all of the messiness of Washington that the president, that David was describing in terms of Republican opposition. Talk about one or two of the issues he highlighted, particularly his request to the Congress for authorization to fight ISIS. So what's the outlook there?
This is going to be a very interesting debate and fight. I mean, you have to. So the president has said, what was interesting about what he said last night was, until now, the White House has said that they don't need authorization to execute the military operation against the Islamic State. And the president last night said, quote, we need this. And that is creating a little bit of a stir, because his argument prior to that said, we don't need this. And so it makes it a little bit tougher in terms of the White House and Congress coming up with the right language. But the way that the White House has seen this is they want the Hill wants language. The White House wants to send language, but they also don't want to send language that then is going to get kicked around and defeated, because that would be worst case scenario. So right now they're trying to work behind the scenes to try to come up with language that they can kind of pull out of a hat and pretend like it wasn't negotiated ahead of time when it really was. And the White House's overall goal is to ultimately replace the 2001 authorization and the Iraq authorization with one broader authorization for things like the Islamic State and also other counterterrorism.
Because that 2001 authorization, a pretty weak read.
But their lawyers said
they're
that
in
they
a
can
funny position
that.
On this, because they are on the one hand saying, we have authorization under 2001, but we'd really like a new authorization. I think I'm more confident about bipartisanship on that than a lot of other things.
I think
Bob Corker, who's now head of the Foreign Relations Committee, has been working closely with them. I just want to correct myself before you get 100 emails. I mentioned Gillibrand and Klobuchar. Obviously, the obvious alternative to Hillary Clinton is Elizabeth Warren, whose ideas sort of haunted that speech a little bit yesterday.
Let me ask you, David, about a couple quickly, several of the other foreign policy issues. He again, said, I want to close Guantanamo. Prospects for that?
I think is probably somewhat is slim. I mean, look, from the Republican perspective, you've got real terrorists sitting there, and the idea of just letting them out is just something that is sort of beyond the pale of understanding here. And so I will tell you, Republicans are digging in pretty hard in terms of that one.
And what about the issue of Iran, where he said, I will veto any attempt to increase sanctions on Iran?
Then it's up to him to come up with an option that works. I mean, if he's saying not sanctions, then he better come up with something that works, because right now that's the only thing that seems to be having any effect.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. One more question, and then I want to get to our callers, lots of whom want to weigh in. I want each of you to give me a sense of one of the ways I always think it's interesting to read a speech is, what did he not say? What did he omit? Anybody notice anything that he omitted that was significant?
Yeah. I'll just go back to he didn't admit that an election just occurred. I mean, he did not want to go there. He didn't want to deal with the consequences of it. And he put his head in the sand and pretend like it didn't happen.
That's an interesting point, because if you look at President Bush, he actually congratulated Speaker Pelosi when he did his 2007 State of the Union, and Obama didn't do anything like that. I thought his comments on the Islamic State were a little interesting in that it didn't reflect the reality that everybody is seeing, in the sense that he said of the Islamic State that, you know, that we're winning in that effort. And even if you talk to folks in the White House, they don't feel that way. They feel like Iraq is kind of, you know, very tenuous, and in Syria it's not working at all. And so that was a little, I didn't quite get why he was leaning into that so much.
EJ?
I think their view on that is actually...
Well, tell me what you...
I noticed the same thing David did, but in reverse, which is that he is not trying to pretend that he's changed his view on anything just because of a low turnout election, as the Democrats see it. But on the Islamic State, I think their view is they're actually gaining ground in Iraq, but not gaining ground in Syria. So it's a very complicated mess. And I agree that his overall sort of picture of American foreign policy was more optimistic than some feel. But I did think he scored a point when he talked about Ukraine, where he said everyone said Putin was strong and we're weak, and now it's his economy that's in tatters.
I'll tell you the words that I didn't hear. I never heard the word poverty. I never heard welfare. I never heard food stamps. All of the economic programs were aimed at working families and kept saying hard-working families. He didn't want to, for all of the talk that this was an orthodox liberal speech, EJ, it was very much, all of his proposals were aimed at working families, not at the at the lowest rung of the economic ladder.
No, I think that's true. And I think that it's always been a tension, I think, in the Democratic Party and among liberals, which is, on the one hand, they really do want to focus on working people, on working class people. And indeed, working class whites are the group that has got moved more to the Republicans than almost any other group, particularly working class white men. On the other hand, a lot of Democrats and liberals think there is an obligation to talk about the poor. And really, the only strong statement on that was his support for the minimum wage, where he was actually very pointed in saying, if you don't want to raise it, you try living.
But that was still about helping someone who's working.
Right. Well, right. But I think the consensus in the country, including the most liberal people around, is that income from work is better than any alternative. And I don't think that's an odd position.
E.J. Dion of The Washington Post, David Winston, Republican strategist, and Carol Lee of The Wall Street Journal. We're back with your calls, your comments, your questions. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects while undergoing treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From Citrix, with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, contractors made up more than 50% of the military workforce in Iraq and Afghanistan, up from just 10% in World War II. What the use of private armies by governments and corporations could mean for international relations and modern warfare. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. Our conversation, of course, is State of the Union and its aftermath. Carol Lee of the Wall Street Journal, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post, David Winston, Republican strategist, all with me. David, you want to make a quick point?
Yeah, no, you were talking before in terms of how the president didn't talk about poverty and those issues and was more focused in terms of sort of working class. And going to Carol's point earlier, one of the fundamental failures of this economic recovery has been that there hasn't been anything in terms of the middle class. And I think the president was somehow trying to grapple with that. But that was ultimately one of the structural failures that's occurring in terms of this particular recovery.
Okay, let's hear some emails from some of our folks who want to get in on this. And this is Jeffrey who writes to us. I have a question. If the top 1% is paying some of the lowest tax rates in decades, then why do Republicans say they will not increase taxes on the top 1%? Is the Republican position just that they are always for lower taxes? Shouldn't they have to say how low? Do they believe the tax rate should be zero? If not, then what is the number? You just can't say lower. What do you think, David?
Well, first off, the wealthy pay more than their a lot of money in terms of taxes. I mean, again, the top 1%, I think, pay about 70% of all personal income tax. That's a pretty sizable item. And the challenge here is how do you make sure this economy recovers? And I would say that trying to increase taxes, which what the president ultimately was proposing, because this is it would land on Chapter S's small businesses and LLC's small businesses, the tax increase that he was talking about would dramatically increase taxes on small businesses. This is not the time to increase taxes on small businesses.
But the whole dialogue we're having is why Obama did this, which is the Republicans end up in a defensive posture because they do consistently say no. We're not going to support these tax cuts for middle-class people unless it's across the board, which means tax cuts for the rich. This is an issue where there's a majority of the country on the side of taxing the rich more because most of the country isn't rich.
It's also it's how it's framed, right? I mean, the same people who are rich fat cats to the Democrats are savers and investors and job creators to Republicans.
Yeah, and this goes back to this discussion we're just having about the middle class. The problem the president is having is he has not figured out through his economic policy to increase the value of middle-class work, the value of those individuals. And so what he's trying to do is governmentally say, okay, arbitrarily, I'm going to increase your value through minimum wage, or I'm just going to give you some money and take it from these people. He hasn't figured out how do we actually increase the value of their work.
Let me read this email from Maxine Carroll. What is the truth concerning the Affordable Care Act? It's something we haven't really talked very much about. The president did say that he would veto any attempt to erode that act. Is it helping uninsured people get affordable insurance? Is it saving the government money? What's the truth? What do we know so far?
Well, I think it has mixed results. I mean, we don't really fully have a complete picture of that. From the White House's perspective, it has insured a lot more people and provided health care to people who otherwise didn't have access or were paying more for it. In terms of the costs, it's just not something that is fully known at this point.
And then Pat writes to us a follow-up. In Joni Ernst's rebuttal, she said Republicans would repeal and replace Obamacare. Republicans saying this for at least 3 years. Does anyone on your panel know the specifics of what they're proposing as a replacement?
Yes. There's been a discussion in terms of this concept called 21st Century Cures, which is the idea that actually when you look at the president's health care plan, the problem is it solved health care as it existed several years ago. How do we actually solve health care as it's going to exist in the next 5 or 10 years? And you've seen some people, specifically Fred Upton, who's the chair of the Commerce Committee, Energy and Commerce Committee for the House, begin to look at that issue and figure out where do we go from here as opposed to how do we solve a problem that existed 5 years ago.
Look, the Obamacare, the rate of the uninsured is lowest it's been. And there are something like at least 10 million people who have health insurance now who probably wouldn't have it. In terms of the cost, whether it's Obamacare or other factors, the cost inflation has been contained in medical care. It's been going down. And so these are good things. And I think the Republicans throw out sort of these vague concepts. They need to put on the table what is their alternative. And I think that's going to be a challenge through the whole Congress. And they're going to have to detail it.
And I absolutely agree with you, Jay. It is up to Republicans at this point to put an alternative on the table, right, just simply opposing the president's health care plan. Interesting point, but doesn't solve people's health care. To EJ's point, Republicans need to put an alternative on.
But let me follow up here with another email that gets at a key point. Barry writes to us, the GOP now painted into the corner. They now have to show they can control their members and actually govern and get something done, or they will look like extremists and lose in 2016. Is that part of the Republican thinking that that the landscape has changed now that we have control of both houses? We do have a sense of responsibility,
yes,
not only to the voters, but to paint a record for 2016.
Yes, because ultimately, look, the one thing that we all know will happen February 2017 is we'll have a different president. Right? I mean, that's just an obvious fact. The challenge here for Republicans is, okay, we've been handed this additional responsibility in terms of governing. What do we do with it? Because the electorate, this wasn't a mandate in the sense of here are five policies we want you to implement. What they were basically saying to Republicans, okay, we are interested in listening to your ideas. We want to give you a chance. There's some ideas we potentially might agree with, but you still have to sell us on those ideas, right? We want to hear where they're going to go and why they're of value to us.
Let me turn to some callers here. And Luis in Tulsa, Oklahoma, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, my name is Luis, and I am attended San Miguel Tolosa Middle School. We are listening live, and I have a question for you.
Please go ahead.
What impact will the Republican Congress have on immigration reform?
Give us a sense of your background. Where is your family from originally?
My family is from Mexico.
And you're a middle school student?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. Thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. Carol, what's your read for Luis?
Well, the Republicans are going to try to peel back some of what the president did executively and in terms of stripping funding. But the president has said he will veto that. And as when we're talking about things that would have enough votes to override a veto, this is not one of them. So there's not much that's going to change unless the Republicans and the White House try to work on some kind of legislation that they can agree on, which seems pretty unlikely.
But David, to your point that we were just talking about, if they're looking toward 2016, you look at the demographics that EJ was mentioned. We all know the numbers. 71% of Hispanics voted for Obama. They're going to be an even bigger percentage of the electorate in the next presidential election. Can Republicans afford to just sit back on immigration, or there compelling reasons to try to come to some package of measures?
Well, I don't think you see Republicans sit back on immigration. There are some starting points. Obviously, you know, there's securing the border, but really where it begins to get more engaging is this concept of what do you do with workers here, the idea of worker permits. Then where does that then lead to? The problem that's occurred here in terms of the lack of discussion is the president said, I want all this and I won't have any other discussion, and basically sent something to the House and said, this is it, take it or leave it. What has to happen here is there's got to be a cooperative discussion in terms of what can happen now. If that occurs, then I think we can move forward. If it's just simply both sides drawing a line in the sand, like has sort of occurred over the past couple of years, then unfortunately I don't see much progress.
The White House waited and waited and waited, and Speaker Boehner said, I want to do this, I want to do this, and nothing happened. So then they acted. And I think you're seeing here the problem John Boehner has in the House. He had to pass a really draconian bill to satisfy his right wing that not only lifted the executive orders on family breakup, they also would lift the protection for the Dreamers, the people who, young people who came, were brought here. This is heard by the Hispanic community, and this is a real problem for the party. And that bill, I don't think, can pass the Senate. Forget the veto.
Well, of course, there were 14 Republican votes in favor of a bill that included a path to legalization.
Right.
So the Senate is a very different place on that issue. Let me turn to John in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, John.
Hi. Thank you. I was a young Republican in high school. I voted for John McCain in 2008, and right now, to pay off my debt for my education, to pay for rent, to pay for food on my table, I have to work 3 part-time jobs. I cannot find full-time work. And for the Republicans to come out and say that they're not in favor of middle-class tax cuts or tax credits, and the richest 1%, an article just came out that said the richest 1% own half the world's wealth by 2016. And it just, I'm never going to be able to vote for Republicans again because I'm working in a situation where I have to struggle in order to keep food on my table. I thank you very much for letting me on, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, John. What do you think, David?
Well, no, I mean, I think it reflects the problem that a lot of college graduates are having, right? The workforce isn't ready to take them in. We don't have an economy that accommodates and is creating jobs for exactly individuals like him. If he had that job, that good job coming out of college, and then many of his economic problems may go by the wayside in terms of then having the income to manage it.
And Carol, this caller really reflects the cloud over the optimism that Obama was talking about last night, because the unemployment rate does not reflect people who are underemployed, which is really closer to 11 or 12%. It doesn't reflect people like this in quite the way his pain and his struggle is reflected. So for all of the optimism of last night, John is still out there.
John is the person that President Obama was talking to last night. He also represents what should be concerning for Republicans and what the White House hopes is concerning for Republicans in terms of painting them into a political corner, in the sense that there is a widespread support for raising taxes on the wealthy. And people like to hear it. It's a line that, that works. And particularly when you talk about raising taxes on the wealthy to redistribute it to the middle class and different tax breaks that, that might benefit them.
Let me turn to Jim in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jim, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, thank you for taking my call, guys. The success of the Republican Party, I believe, is built soundly on the idea that unless you accommodate business, they will take their football and leave the field. And what is incredibly difficult for me to stomach is the fact that that business, American business and global business, has abandoned the working class in the United States, and at the same time, the conservative policies of the last 40 years have crippled the union movement. Unless we have strong unions or we have high tariffs to keep these goods out of our shores, we will never have a middle class as we once did. The middle class was built from the success of most of the world being destroyed by World War II in combination with the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Thank you very much for your call. EJ, of course, you've written many times about the importance from your point of view of strength in labor unions.
Right. I mean, what you've seen is first of all, that caller is the problem both parties have, and they should pay attention because you have had a fundamental change in this economy that comes from declining worker bargaining power, globalization, technological change, and a whole lot of other factors. And the discontent he feels is felt in a substantial way. I was struck last night. You hadn't heard all that much from President Obama about unions. He very pointedly said we need to strengthen unions and worker bargaining power in this economy. But there is legit discontent out there, and that is why he pitched this speech to middle-class workers.
I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But at the same time, for all of the virtues of bargaining and unions, on the issue of trade, when this caller says the answer is protective tariff, there's no economist in the world who would agree with that caller that protective tariffs is the way to increase his economic situation. And that's part of the misimpression, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, his economic value is that there are markets to buy products that he's helping to produce, right? And what trade's going to do is, in fact, open up, I think the president said 95% of consumers are outside this country. I'm not sure that that's the right number for all products. But the bottom line is if there's no market for products, then there's no value in terms of what the American worker is producing. And that's the challenge here, and that's why trade has to happen. And that's why I think, again, of all the issues that are out there at this point, the one that has the best chance of succeeding is trade.
You know, EJ, I always remember an old unionist I interviewed many years ago said, look, you got to understand, Roberts, that we represent the people who have jobs now, not the people who might have jobs in the future, and that unions, almost by definition, are backward-looking when it comes to trade. It's their responsibility in some ways, but they can't see into the future for jobs that will be created.
Well, they also, and the president acknowledged this in his speech, most of these trade deals have not lived up to their promises to working people. If all these trade deals were so great for the economy, why have wages stagnated? And so I agree trade is a complicated question. I'm more agnostic on trade than most people. But I think that people who just keep saying more trade deals will increase the living standard of the American worker, they have a lot to answer for because that hasn't happened for a whole lot of workers, not just incumbent workers.
I want to give each of you a chance to sum up here and look forward. Last 2 years of this presidency, he keeps talking about the fourth quarter. I was surprised he didn't invoke the Seattle Seahawks and Russell Wilson.
Of the
wonders of fourth quarter comebacks, but given all of his sports analogies. But give me a sense of what we can look forward to in this fourth quarter, David.
Now, I think what you're going to see here is there's on the Republican side, there's an opportunity to show how to govern. And I think what you're going to see is basically three potential outcomes that's going to occur in terms of every piece of legislation. One, you get the president to sign off on it. That's governing. Two, where there's a potential – where you can get it to the Senate, the president vetoes. That potentially defines a choice in the future. And then there are going to be things that are done for the Republican base. The question is – as we move forward, what ends up in each one of those? And I think the real opportunity here for Republicans, and again, this was a pretty decisive election in terms of this size of a majority. The challenge here is, what do Republicans do with that majority? And going back to what we were talking about before, part of that responsibility is offering alternatives.
Carol?
Well, there's a phrase that in the White House they throw around a lot, and that is, a lot of things get done in the fourth quarter. On the foreign policy piece, Cuba, you know, you have a president that's looking at his legacy very seriously. Cuba, Iran, and, you know, Guantanamo Bay. The Congress may not go along with the president, but this is a president who's very determined and has ordered his staff to come up with ways for him to do this unilaterally if he has to. That's a very important piece of business for him. Personally, in terms of the economy, if he just gets the conversation started on the middle class, even if he doesn't get a lot of what he wants, I think that's seen as a victory for him as well.
Quick final word, DJ.
On foreign policy, we may see some real cooperation, particularly on an authorization of the use of force. On trade, we're going to have a fight that splits both parties. But when even Republicans are saying that the issue in politics is wage stagnation, you're actually having an argument on progressive turf. And it's going to be very interesting to see what are the Republicans put on the table as an alternative to what the president has proposed.
Last word from E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post, Brookings Institution, Carol Lee, White House correspondent of the Wall Street Journal, David Winston, Republican strategist. Thanks you all for being with us this morning. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Reiman. Thanks so much for spending an hour of your morning with us.
The Diane Reim Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted.